This is the Breaker.News podcast for June 10th, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Around the Rim, headlines about the Pacific Rim. Cascadia Calling, headlines about the Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, the Breaker goes on location to the Ironworkers Memorial Second Narrows Crossing to interview George Orr about his new documentary, The Bridge. 60 years ago, on June 17, 1958, the Second Narrows Bridge collapsed and 19 men died in the waters below. And I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or did Ontario wait too long to get rid of Kathleen Wynne and the Liberal Party government? After all the scandals during Wynne's tenure and that of her predecessor, Dalton McGuinty, Ontario voters decided to throw the bums out on June 7th. It was another case of voting out a party, not voting in a party, as Doug Ford and the Progressive Conservatives gained 100% of the power, but with only 40% of the popular vote. This will put wind in the sails of proportional representation campaigners in both Ontario and BC, especially BC, where a referendum is coming this fall. But why are we looking so narrowly at the voting system when Canada's democracy, or lack of it, needs a top-to-bottom overhaul? There is too much power concentrated in the office of the Premier, and federally, the Prime Minister's office. The same goes for the offices of some big city mayors. Sean Holman's 2013 documentary, called Whipped, described the archaic system of party discipline. Our politicians represent their leader to us, not us to their leader. They toe the party line rather than working together with lawmakers from other parties to help better our communities. Our leaders don't have a legislated limit on how many terms in office they can serve. In their nonstop campaigns between elections, politicians in power rely too heavily on spending millions of dollars on propaganda, and they do whatever they can to evade the transparency and accountability laws of freedom of information. But suppose for a moment that BC does away with the first-past-the-post system. Then what? Well, citizens will still be stuck looking at the wrong end of the horse. What do you think? Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In The Australian, Greg Sheridan reports, bipartisan reply to China is a triumph we'll need to repeat. The espionage and foreign interference legislation that a bipartisan parliamentary committee has now approved is a response to blatant Chinese espionage and interference in Australia. The legislation has upset Beijing. Canberra and Beijing are involved in disagreements over a bewildering range of issues at the moment. The good news is that when this legislation and the related Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme bill are finally passed, this part of Canberra's disagreement with Beijing can go back off the public boil. Beijing's foreign influence strategy is multidimensional, has many diverse parts, and is well coordinated, well calibrated, and pretty effective. Australians should understand that we are not alone in these experiences. The U.S. intends to emulate our foreign interference legislation. In the Honolulu Star Advertiser, Andrew Gomez reports that volcanic activity burns biggest economic driver for Big Island. The National Park Service estimates the impact of the Kilauea eruptions to date at $13 million, compounding difficulties for the hundreds of residents who have lost or been driven from their homes. Businesses that closely drive income from park visitors, such as nearby restaurants and tour companies, are suffering. Some have laid off employees. The National Park Service says it contributes $166 million to the local economy every year by helping fill hotels, restaurants, and tours. That's $455,000 a day. Last year, the park attracted about 2.16 million visitors, up from 1.89 million the year before. The most recent comparison of Hawaii tourist attractions shows that 1.82 million visitors went to Pearl Harbor in 2016. In the South China Morning Post, Zigor Aldama reports, has the legacy of China's one-child policy destroyed Xi Jinping's World Cup dream? Despite the country building world-class infrastructure and employing some of the best foreign coaches, China's footballers have yet to become world beaters, with players born under the one-child policy lacking cooperation skills. China has qualified for the World Cup only once, in 2002, when the tournament was co-hosted by Japan and South Korea, and Team Dragon failed to score a single goal. And it comes as no surprise that the country will not be playing in Russia this month. Despite having tens of millions of fans to cheer them on, China are repeatedly humiliated on the football pitch. But the government has a plan. President Xi expressed three wishes in 2015: to qualify for another World Cup, to host one, and to win one within 30 years. These wishes became orders, and thus the Chinese Football Reform and Development Program was conceived and approved soon after by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China and the State Council. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Times columnist, Carlo Wilson reports, Greater Victoria, Quebec City tied for lowest unemployment rate. Greater Victoria and Quebec City were tied with the lowest unemployment rate in the country at 3.9% in May, below the national rate of 5.8%. The capital region's employment climbed by 3,700 in May from April, putting the total number of people working at almost 200,000. Local capital region employers are struggling to find entry-level to skilled workers in today's tight job market. The rate in April was 4.2%. In the Skagit Valley Herald, Kimberly Covell reports, thousands of crab pots are lost in Puget Sound each year. They're dedicated to finding them. Northwest Straits operates the program because derelict, meaning lost or abandoned, crab pots can catch and kill valuable Dungeness crabs and other marine wildlife. The program targets areas such as those north of Saddlebag Island, where lost crab pots are concentrated due to the location's popularity among crabbers, water movement, and changes in water depth. Northwest Straits Foundation Marine Project Manager Jason Morgan said, since first recovering derelict crab pots in 2003, the Northwest Straits program has removed about 5,400 of them from the region's marine waters. About 1,200 of those were recovered from sites in Skagit County. In those pots from throughout the region, Northwest Straits has documented about 1,100 dead crabs, including Dungeness and Red Rock, as well as other wildlife. Northwest Straits has been working for years on the project to find and retrieve lost fishing nets that often ensnare wildlife. About 5,800 nets have now been recovered, with about 480,000 fish, birds, and mammals, some dead and some alive, stuck in them. In the Creston Valley Advance, Trudeau denies negative interaction after old BC editorial alleging misbehavior goes viral. An editorial column printed 18 years ago in the Creston Valley Advance newspaper alleges inappropriate behavior by the future Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It went viral on social media this week. Trudeau had been in Creston to celebrate the Kokanee Summit Festival, organized by the Columbia Brewery, and accepted $18,500 raised for a campaign that his family had launched in memory of Justin's brother, Michelle, who died in an avalanche near Nelson in 1998. A story published earlier in the Advance, entitled Mixed Reaction to Camp Kokanee, on August 10th, details the event's party-like atmosphere, with plenty of drinking and dancing to live music. However, one woman was quoted anonymously as saying, "It wasn't a good place to be if you're female," saying she was touched several times inappropriately. Attempts to contact the female reporter have been so far unsuccessful. The editorial starts, "I'm sorry, if I had known you were reporting for a national paper, I never would have been so forward." Those were the words spoken to an Advance reporter by Justin Trudeau on August 4th, 2000. The reporter was on assignment for the Advance, the National Post, and the Vancouver Sun. And these were some of the top stories this week in the Breaker.News. Who are the people in the Whitby Estates neighborhood in West Vancouver? The Breaker analyzed property assessment records for 60 mansions and townhouses that were built since 2009 and marketed to government officials and gamblers from China. And horse owners and horse breeders at Hastings Racecourse went public with their calls for Great Canadian Gaming to leave in favor of a new company that is willing to invest in the track's decrepit backstretch. Read those stories and more in the Breaker.News.
19 scarlet roses the chaplain spread around in the waters of Burrard Inlet in old Vancouver town, where the bridge came tumbling down. When the bridge came tumbling down, 19 men were drowned in June of 1958 in old Vancouver town.
That was part of The Bridge Came Tumbling Down by Stompin' Tom Connors, which tells the story in song about June 17, 1958, the day the Second Narrows Bridge collapsed and 19 construction workers died in the waters below. Survivors will gather on June 17th, as they do every year, to lay wreaths at the monument on the south end of the bridge. To mark the 60th anniversary, filmmaker George Orr is premiering his documentary called The Bridge at the Van City Theater on June 17th. It includes never-before-seen footage of the bridge being built and of the aftermath. The Breaker went on location to the Iron Workers Memorial Second Narrows Crossing to interview George Orr. This is The Big Deal on the Breaker.News podcast. This week, our special guest is George Orr, documentary filmmaker, of a new documentary about the Second Narrows Bridge, the Iron Workers Memorial Second Narrows Bridge, and what happened on June 17th, 1958. What did happen on that day that a lot of Vancouverites, a lot of Canadians don't know about that they should know about?
About 3:40 in the afternoon, there were 79 men working on this bridge, steel workers. They felt a lurch. It went bump. And then it fell out from under them. A lot of men went into the water. 19 men died that day. It's the biggest industrial accident in the city's history.
And that's where we are right now, near the south end, near the memorial at the south end, where every year the dwindling number of iron workers who were there that day, who were lucky enough to survive, come and remember their fallen comrades and others about this industrial incident, about this very important transport link to the North Shore. You described that in the documentary about what this meant to Vancouver from all kinds of angles.
Well, Vancouver was growing as really quickly after the war. During the Second War, there was a huge shipbuilding industry in North Vancouver, and workers were ferried back and forth because there was only the Lionsgate Bridge. So there was a huge demand for a new bridge across the Second Narrows. The government decided in the mid-50s to get it done. And for the day, it was a six-lane bridge. It was a huge undertaking, and it was going to modernize Vancouver, connect the North Shore, and help the city grow.
Yeah, here we are in 2018, and about 120,000 cars and trucks go back and forth every day. This is a very important bridge. And this documentary is a fascinating documentary because you have never-before-seen footage by Peter Hall, who was working on the project. Talk about that.
Young draftsman Peter Hall had come out from England. He got a job with Dominion Bridge. He'd been an engineer in Britain, but he'd not finished all his engineering schooling here in BC. So he got a job as a draftsman, but he was very good. So he was able to do a day's work in less than a day. The company public relations guy gave him a 16mm camera and said, here's lots of film, document the construction. So young Peter, having never shot much film before, crawled out onto the span and shot everything from the pouring of the concrete and the drawing of the plans to the cutting of the ribbon by W.A.C. Bennett. Had he been here 5 minutes earlier on the day it collapsed, he would have died because he was here to watch a 55-ton beam go into place, and that's the beam that took down the bridge.
How did Peter get connected with you and you get this into the documentary form as it is?
Well, you'd relate to this as... as a news person, you're looking for the greatest story never told, and you never know when it's going to happen. And in the Parksville Qualicum Daily News back in July, there was a small article about a retired engineer who built a flagpole for his retirement community. And he mentioned in the article a little bit of film about the bridge, so I phoned him as soon as I read it. 3,000 feet of 16mm color film, had never been all out of the can before, and he was a little suspicious of what I was up to. But over the last, I guess, 9 months, we've become friends. I've seen the footage. I've helped him produce the documentary he always thought he should. We brought in more people, brought in reporters who covered the story, brought in rescuers who helped pull survivors out of the water, brought in investigators who helped determine what happened. And so it's a story not just about then, but it's a story through the eyes of old men about who they were 60 years ago, what they did, how they participated in this tragic event.
And this event
has really not been given the respect that it has been due. Of course, Stompin' Tom Connor's song really is the only cultural document that all of Canadians have been able to hear and access over the years. This time, though, you have included that at the end, but you've told the whole story about through the eyes of those who were there, who were affected. You've also talked about the cause, that it was a mathematical error.
They were building an arch out over the water, and it had to be supported. The support wasn't a permanent structure, so in those days, things that weren't permanent structures didn't require an engineer's stamp. Everything else required an engineer to check it and double-check it to certify it. But the temporary structure, it was called a false banner. The temporary structure wasn't permanent, so it wasn't certified. The measurement on the steel was just a little bit thin, and that's what brought down the bridge.
It's quite fascinating how you show that workers had to be extra careful because they didn't have the safety that we do have today.
I have trouble walking out on the bridge on the sidewalk safely looking down. These guys, because they were all men, were walking on thin pieces of steel 200 feet over the water, carrying 60-pound tools with no safety, nothing. They wore life jackets that weren't really much help, as it turned out. And they did it for functionally a couple of bucks an hour. It was they built the city. They've had very little recognition. This city doesn't realize much of its history, doesn't recognize or celebrate much of its history. So my thought with this story is that's what I want to do. Celebrate this history, celebrate the sacrifices these men made, and have people understand what it takes to build a city like Vancouver.
And you've got some of the survivors in there, their words, their emotions. It's almost as if to some of them that it happened yesterday.
There are three survivors left, Lou Lessard, Norm Atkinson, and Gary Poirier. I sat Gary down at some length and talked about his experience riding the bridge into the water, being in the water, being essentially smashed to pieces and recovering. They're having a ceremony here on the 60th anniversary of that collapse. Those three survivors will be here, and they're old men. Their lives were broken and changed that day, and as were hundreds of families. And huge impact in the Lower Mainland. It was the biggest story of the decade.
And for so many years, this was just known as the Second Narrows Bridge, but now it is the Iron Workers Memorial Second Narrows Bridge, and you tell the story in the documentary about how that came to be.
Actually, it ends up being a story a little bit about CBC Radio. They had a new announcer, a new, a morning show host in town, Rick Clough, in the 90s, as he was touring around Vancouver to learn the geography so we could talk about it. He asked why this was not called the Iron Workers Memorial, because that's what it was. And he made a crusade out of it to make this place recognize its history. And so it's now officially the Iron Workers Memorial. Everybody calls it that. Not everybody understands what that means. And that's the purpose of the documentary.
And it's very important to have a documentary like this when in Canada, in BC especially, there's always infrastructure being built, and you got to make sure that the infrastructure is being built correctly and also safely.
It takes one little mistake to take down a bridge like this. If it had been a mistake at a later point, I mean, we're looking at cars going by now, it's six lanes of traffic. The horror if this bridge went down, or a bridge like this went down today, is unimaginable. So engineers have to be perfect, and they are. And so we have built a... We build our country on the backs and the brains of engineers who are precise in every aspect. A lot was learned from this bridge, and a lot of engineering principles were changed and modified and brought up to date from the lessons learned, so that hopefully it'll never happen again.
Well, thank you very much, George Orr, for sitting down here by the south end of the Iron Workers Memorial Second Narrows Bridge to talk about the documentary that you've done to commemorate this piece of tragic history here in British Columbia.
Can I add one thing? I worked on a project about the coming of the Olympics. I shot it over the course of about 10 years. It's not quite, I don't know if it'll ever get done. This will be embarrassing for you. The only journalist I knew in the entire exercise of covering the Olympics who actually held feet to the fire was you. So I hold you in great, great admiration, great respect.
Thank you very much.
The Bridge, a documentary directed by George Orr, premieres on June 17th at the Vancouver International Film Festival's Van City Theatre. Screenings are also scheduled for June 20th, June 24th, and July 7th. Go to viff.org or call the box office at 604-683-3456. That's 604-683-3456.
Remember and be kind. The bridge came tumbling down, and 19 men were drowned. So you could ride to the other side of old Vancouver Town. So you could ride to the other side of old Vancouver Town.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Howard Kelsey and his team for bringing back the bathtub races to English Bay. More than 20 customized tubs will race a mile track off Kitsilano Beach on the second day of the 10th annual Kits Fest, which runs August 10th to 12th. From 1967 to 1996, Kits was the finish line for the epic Nanaimo to Vancouver World Championship Bathtub Race, organized by the Loyal Nanaimo Bathtub Society. If you're on Vancouver Island on July 22nd, catch the 51st annual race in Nanaimo, which celebrates the centennial of the birth of the late great bathtub booster Frank Ney. In a province that is changing so rapidly, the Breaker salutes folks like Howard Kelsey and the Loyal Nanaimo Bathtub Society for keeping these traditions alive. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for June 10th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on June 10th, 1963, President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act into law? It made it illegal for employers in the U.S. to pay men more than women, or vice versa, except for seniority and merit. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas. The email address is bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week,